she said. "My brother. Let's all think of him, shall we? As if we ever do anything else. He could have stood up to Mother over this. Instead, he did nothing. Nothing at all." I had never heard her criticize Roderick before, except in fun, and I was startled by her fierceness. But at the same time her swollen eyes were growing redder, and her voice was weakening, and I think she knew there was no other way. She turned to gaze back out of the window. I stood watching her in silence, then said gently, "You must be brave, Caroline. I'm sorry. Shall I see to it now?"
"God,"
she said, closing her eyes. "Caroline, he's old."
"Does that make it better?"
"I give you my word, he won't suffer." She sat tensely for a moment, then her shoulders sank. She let out her breath, and all the bitterness seemed to bleed away from her. She said,
"Oh, take him. Everything else has gone. Why not take him, too? I'm sick of fighting it."
Her tone was so bleak that at last I saw through her stubbornness to other losses and griefs, and I felt I'd been misjudging her. She put her hand on the dog's head as she spoke, and he, understanding that she was talking about him, but also hearing the distress in her voice, looked up at her with trust and concern, then rose on his front legs and moved his muzzle towards her face.
"You idiotic dog," she said, letting him lick her.
Then she pushed him away.
"Dr. Faraday wants you. Can't you see?"
I said, "Shall I do it here?"
"No, I don't want that. I don't want to see it. Take him downstairs somewhere. Go on, Jip."
And she pushed him to me almost roughly, so that he stumbled from the ottoman to the floor.
"Go on,"
she said again, when he hesitated.
"You stupid thing! Dr. Faraday wants you, I told you. Go on."
So Jip came faithfully to me, and after a final glance at Caroline, I led him from the room and quietly closed the door behind me. He followed me down through the house to the kitchen, and I took him out to the scullery, and had him lie down on an old rug. He knew that was strange, for Caroline was strict about his routines, but then he must have known there was upset in the house, and perhaps could even guess that he was the cause of it. I wondered what notions were swimming about in his mind, what memories of the party, and whether he thought of what he had done, and was guilty or ashamed. But when I looked into his eyes, it seemed to me that I could see only confusion there. And after I had opened my bag and taken out what I needed, I touched his head and said to him, as I'd said to him once before, "Here's a to-do, Jip. But never mind now. You're a good old dog." And I went on, murmuring nonsense like that, and I held my arm beneath his shoulders, so that after the injection had taken effect, he sank onto my hand, and I felt the faltering of his heart against my palm, and then the failing of it. Mrs. Ezra told me that Barrett would bury him, so I covered him over with the rug, then washed my hands and went back into the kitchen. I found Mrs. Baisley there. She had just arrived and was tying on her apron. When I told her what I'd been doing, she shook her head, distressed.
"Ain't that a shame?" she said. "The house won't seem right without that old hound in it. Can you make it out, Doctor? I've seen him about the place all his life, and I'd have taken me oath on there being no more harm in him than in the hairs on me own head. I'd have trusted him with me grandchild, I would."
"So would I, Mrs. Baisley," I answered miserably, "if I had one." But there was the kitchen table, after all, to remind me of that recent horrible night. And there, too, I hadn't noticed her before, there was Betty. She was standing half-concealed by a door which led to one of the kitchen passages. She had a pile of newly dried dishcloths and was folding them up, but she moved with an odd jerkiness, her narrow shoulders seeming to twitch, and I realized after a second or two that she was crying. She turned her head and saw me watching, and began to weep harder. She said, with a violence that amazed me,
"That poor old dog, Dr. Faraday! Everybody's blaming him, but it wasn't his fault. It isn't fair."
Her voice broke down, and Mrs. Baisley went across to her to take her in her arms.
"There, now," the woman said, awkwardly patting Betty's back. "You see how this have upset us, Doctor? We dunno what we're about. Betty's got some idea in her head. I dunno."
She looked embarrassed.
"Her thinks that little girl getting bit has somewhat peculiar to it."
I said, "Something peculiar? What on earth do you mean?" Betty drew back her head from Mrs. Baisley's shoulder and said,
"There's a bad thing in this house, that's what. There's a bad thing, and he makes wicked things happen."
I stared at her for a moment, then lifted my hand to rub my face. "Oh, Betty!"
"It's true! I felled him!"
She looked from me to Mrs. Baisley. Her grey eyes were wide, and she was shivering slightly. But I had the sense, as I'd sometimes had before with her, that at heart she was enjoying the fuss and attention. I said less patiently, "All right. We're all tired, and we're all sorry."
"It isn't tiredness!"
"All right." Now I spoke sharply. "This is pure silliness, and you know it. This house is big and lonely. But I thought you were used to that now."
"I am used to it. It isn't just that."
"It isn't anything. There's nothing bad here, nothing spooky. What happened with Jip and that poor child, it was a horrible accident, that's all."
"It wasn't an accident. It were the bad thing, whispering to Jip, or nipping him."
"Did you hear a whisper?" She spoke reluctantly.
"No."
"No. And neither did I. And neither did anyone else in all that crowd of people at the party. Mrs. Baisley, have you seen any sign of this bad thing of Betty's?" Mrs. Baisley shook her head.
"No, I haven't, Doctor. I've never seen nothing queer here at all."
"And how long have you been coming to this house?"
"Well, very nearly 10 years.
"There you are, then," I said to Betty. "Doesn't that reassure you?"
"No, it don't," she answered. "Just 'cause she haven't seen it don't mean it ain't true. It might be a new thing."
I said, "Oh, for goodness sake. Come on, now be a good girl and wipe your eyes. And I hope," I added, "you won't go mentioning any of this to Mrs. Ayres or to Miss Caroline. It's about the last thing they need at the moment. They've been good to you, remember? Remember how they called me in for you that time you were poorly in July?" I looked into her face as I said this. She caught my meaning and coloured, but her expression, despite the blush, grew mulish. She said in a whisper,
"There is a bad thing. There is."
Then she hid her face against Mrs. Baisley's shoulder and wept again, as bitterly as before. Chapter 5. Not surprisingly, in the weeks that followed, life at Hundreds Hall seemed very changed and discouraged and sad. There was, for one thing, simply the physical absence of Jip to get used to. The days were naturally sombre now, but the house seemed extra dim and lifeless, without the dog trotting affably from room to room. Since I was still going out to the hall once a week to treat Rod's leg, it had become easier for me to let myself in like one of the family, and sometimes, opening up the door, I'd find myself listening out for the click and pad of paws. Or else I'd turn my head to a shadow, thinking that the dark shape at the corner of my vision must be Jip's, and having to suffer, every time, a pang of dismay, as all that had happened came rushing back to me. I mentioned this to Mrs. Ayres, and she nodded. She had stood in the hall one rainy afternoon, she said, quite convinced that she could hear the dog pattering about upstairs. The sound was so distinct she'd gone, almost nervously, up to look, and realized that what she'd taken as the sound of his claws on the floorboards was really the rapid drip of water from a broken gutter outside. Something similar happened to Mrs. Baisley. She found herself making up a bowl of bread and gravy and setting it down by the kitchen door, as she'd used to do for Jip in the old days. She let it sit there for half an hour, all the time wondering where the dog was, and then almost cried, she said, when she remembered he was gone.
"And the queer thing was," she told me, "I only done it because I thought I heard him coming down the basement steps. You know how he used to huff, like an old chap? I could have sworn I heard it."
As for poor Caroline, how often she mistook some other sound for the skitter of Jip's claws, or turned to a shadow, supposing it him, I simply don't know. She had Barrett dig a grave for him among the marble headstones which formed a quaint little pet's cemetery in one of the park's plantations. She made a dreary tour of the house, collecting the water bowls and blankets that had been kept in various rooms for the dog's use, and putting them away. But she seemed, in the process, to seal up her own upset and grief with a thoroughness which unnerved me. On my first visit to the hall after that miserable morning when I had put Jip to sleep, I made a point of seeking her out, not wanting there to be any bad feeling between us. But when I asked her how she was, she said only, in a brisk, expressionless voice,
"I'm fine. It's all done now, isn't it? I'm sorry I spoke so wildly that time. It wasn't your fault, I know that. It's finished. Let me show you this that I found yesterday in one of the rooms upstairs."
And she brought out some antique trinket she had unearthed from the back of a drawer, and didn't refer to Jip again. I felt I didn't know her well enough to force the issue, but I spoke about her with her mother, who seemed to think that she would recover in her own way.
"Caroline's never been much of a girl for displaying her feelings," she told me with a sigh. "But she's awfully sensible. That's why I brought her back to help with her brother when he was hurt. She was as good as any nurse in those days, you know. And have you heard the latest news? Mrs. Rossiter came out to tell us just this morning. Apparently the Baker Hydes are leaving. They're taking the little girl back to London. The staff are following next week. Poor Standish is to be shut up and sold again. But I do think it's for the best. Imagine Caroline or Roderick or I forever running into that family, in Lidcote or Leamington."
I was relieved by this news, too. I hadn't relished the prospect of regularly seeing the Baker Hydes any more than Mrs. Ayres had. I was also pleased that the county newspapers had at last lost interest in the case, and though nothing could be done about local gossip, and though sometimes a patient or colleague of mine would raise the affair with me, knowing I had been slightly involved, whenever the subject arose I always did my best to turn or close it, and talk soon died down. But still I wondered about Caroline. Now and then, as I drove my car across the park, I would catch sight of her, just as I'd used to, and without Jip trotting beside her, she struck me as a terribly forlorn figure. If I stopped the car to speak to her, she seemed willing enough to talk in what was more or less her old manner. She looked as sturdy and as healthy as she always had. Only her face, I thought, betrayed the wretchedness of the past few weeks, for caught at certain angles it seemed heavier and plainer than ever, as if, with the loss of her dog, there had come something like the loss of the last of her optimism and her youth.
"Does Caroline talk to you about how she's feeling?" I asked her brother one day in November, as I was treating his leg. He shook his head, frowning.
"She doesn't seem to want to."
"You can't bring her out? Make her open up a little?" The frown grew deeper.
"I suppose I could try. I never seem to have the time."
I said lightly, "No time for your sister?" He didn't answer, and I remember looking on in concern as his face darkened, and he turned his head from me as if not trusting himself to reply. The fact is, at this point I felt almost more uneasy over him than over Caroline. That the business with Jip and the Baker Hydes should have left its mark on her was understandable, but it seemed to have had some sort of devastating impact on him too, which quite perplexed me. It was not just a question of his being preoccupied and withdrawn, of his spending too much time at work in his room, for that had been true of him for months. It was an extra something that I saw, or sensed, forever at the back of his expression. Some burden of knowledge, or even of fear. I hadn't forgotten what his mother had told me, about how she had found him on the night of the party. It seemed to me that if this new phase of his behaviour had started anywhere, it was there. I had tried several times to raise the subject with him, and every time he had found some way, through silence or evasion, of putting me off. Perhaps I should have left him to it. I was certainly busy enough on my own account in those days, for the colder weather had brought along its usual rash of winter ailments, and my rounds were heavy. But it was against all my instincts to let the matter rest, and, more than that, I simply felt involved with a family now. In a way, I hadn't even 3 or 4 weeks before. So, when I had put the electrodes in place and started up the coil, I told him plainly what was bothering me. His reaction appalled me.
"That's my mother's idea of keeping a confidence, is it?"
he said, moving furiously about in his chair.
"I suppose I should have expected it. Just what did she tell you? That she found me in a blue funk?"
"She was worried about you."
"God! I simply didn't feel like turning out for some idiotic party. My head was killing me. I sat in my room and had a drink. Then I went to bed. Is that a crime?"
"Rod, of course it isn't. It's just the way she described it."
"For God's sake! She exaggerates. She imagines things all the time. As for what's actually under her nose, oh, forget it. If she thinks I'm about to go off my head, leave her to it. She has no idea. You none of you have. If you only knew..."
He bit the words back. Puzzled by the intensity of his manner, I said, "If we knew what?" He sat rigid for a moment, clearly struggling with himself. Then,
"Oh, forget it.
he said again, and he moved sharply forward, catching hold of the wires that ran from his leg to the coil and pulling them free.
"Forget all this, too. I'm tired of it. It's no damn good."
The electrodes sprang out of their bindings and tumbled to the floor. He tugged the elastics loose, then clumsily rose, and with his trouser leg still rolled high and his foot bare, he went over to stand at his desk, turning his back to me. I gave the treatment up that day, and abandoned him to his temper. The following week he apologized, and we ran through the process as normal. He seemed to have quite calmed down. By my next visit, however, something new had started happening. I arrived at the house to find him with a cut on the bridge of his nose, and a bad black eye.
"Now don't look like that," he said when he saw my face. "I've had Caroline fussing over me all morning, trying to stick bits of bacon to me and God knows what else."
I glanced at his sister. She was sitting there with him in his room. I think she had been waiting for me. Then went over to him to take his head in my hands and turn his face to the light of the window. What on earth happened?
"A very stupid thing indeed," he said, irritably drawing himself free. "And I'm almost too embarrassed to mention it. I work in the night, that's all, and went blundering out to the lavatory. And some fool, i.e. me, had left the door wide open, so that I went smack into the edge of it."
"He knocked himself out," said Caroline. "It's only thanks to Betty that he didn't, I don't know, swallow his own tongue."
"Don't be silly," said her brother. "I didn't knock myself out."
"You did. He was flat on the floor, Doctor, and he'd given such a cry he'd woken up Betty downstairs. Poor girl, I think she thought we had burglars. She crept up and saw him lying there, and very sensibly came and woke me. He was still out cold when I came down to him."
Rod scowled.
"Don't listen to her, Doctor. She's exaggerating."
"I'm not, you know," said Caroline. "We had to throw water in his face to bring him round, and when he came to he was most ungrateful. Told us in very nasty language to leave him alone."
"All right," said her brother. "We seem to have proved that I'm an idiot. But I think I told you that myself. Now, can we leave it?"
He spoke sharply. Caroline looked disconcerted for a moment, then found a way to turn the subject. He wouldn't join in, however, but sat in moody silence while she and I chatted. And for the first time, when I prepared to treat him, he refused outright to let me do it, saying again that he was tired of it, that it was doing no good. His sister stared at him in amazement.
"Oh, Rod, you know that's not true."
He answered peevishly,
"It's my leg, isn't it?"
"But for Dr. Faraday to have gone to so much trouble—"
"Well, if Dr. Faraday wants to put himself out for people he hardly knows," he said, "that's his lookout. I tell you, I'm tired of being pinched and pulled about. Or are my legs estate property like everything else around here? Got to patch them up, get a bit more wear out of them. Never mind that you're grinding them down to stumps. Is that what you're thinking?"
"Rod, you aren't being fair."
"It's all right," I said quietly. "Rod doesn't have to have the treatment if he doesn't want it. It isn't as though he's paying for it."
"But," said Caroline, as if she hadn't heard, "your paper—"
"My paper's practically written. And, as I think Rod knows, the best effect's already been achieved. All I'm doing now is keeping the muscle ticking over." Rod himself had moved away and wouldn't talk to us. In the end we left him to it and joined Mrs. Ayres in the little parlour for a subdued tea. But before I left I went quietly down to the basement to have a word with Betty, and she confirmed what Caroline had told me about the previous night. She had been fast asleep, she said, and had been woken by a cry. Muddled with slumber, she thought that one of the family wanted her, and had gone dozily upstairs. She found Rod's door open, and Rod himself lying on the floor with blood on his face, so still and white that for a second she'd supposed him dead, and had very nearly screamed. Pulling herself together, she had run to fetch Caroline, and between them they had brought him round. He had woken up.
"Cursing and saying funny things?"
I said, "What sort of things?" She screwed up her face, trying to remember.
"Just funny things. Queer things. Like when the dentist gives you gas."
And that was all she could tell me, so I was obliged to let the matter go. A few days later, however, when the bruise on his eye had turned a lovely shade of what Caroline called greenery yallery, but well before it had faded completely, Rod suffered another small injury. Again he had apparently woken in the night and gone blundering across his room. This time he had walked into a footstool, which had mysteriously left its usual place to set itself directly in his path,
and he had tripped and fallen and hurt his wrist. He tried to play the incident down to me, and he let me bind up the injured wrist with a tremendous air of humouring the old man, but I could tell from the look of his arm and from his reaction when I handled it that the sprain was quite a bad one, and his attitude baffled me. I spoke about it later to his mother. She at once looked anxious, putting her hands together, as she often did now, to turn her old-fashioned rings.
"What do you think the matter is, truly?" she asked me. "He won't tell me anything. I've tried and tried. Clearly he's not sleeping. Then again, I don't think any of us is sleeping well just now. But all this wandering about at night, it can't be healthy, can it?"
"You think he did stumble, then?"
"What else? His leg is at its stiffest when he's been lying down."
"That's true. But the footstool?"
"Well, he keeps that room in such a frightful state. He always has."
"But doesn't Betty tidy it?" She caught the note of concern in my voice, and her gaze sharpened with alarm. She said,
"You don't think, do you, that there's something seriously wrong with him? He can't have been suffering from more of those headaches."
But I had already thought of that. I had asked him about his headaches while bandaging his wrist, and he'd answered that, apart from his two small injuries, he had no physical ailments at all. He seemed to be speaking truthfully. And though he looked tired, I could see no sign of actual illness in him, in his eye, his manner, or complexion. There was only that elusive something, faint as a scent or a shadow, that continued to perplex me. His mother looked so concerned I didn't like to burden her further. I remembered her tears on the night I had gone out there after the party. I told her I was probably worrying needlessly, rather playing the whole thing down, just like Rod himself. But I was bothered enough to want to talk to someone about it, so I made an excuse to call in at the hall later that week, and I sought out Caroline to speak to her alone. I found her in the library. She was sitting cross-legged on the floor, with a tray of leather-bound books in front of her. She was rubbing lanolin into their covers. She had just enough weak north light to work by, for in the recent damp weather the window shutters had begun to warp, and she had only been able to open one of them, and that only partly. White sheets still hung across most of the shelves, like so many shrouds. She hadn't bothered to light a fire, and the room was very chill and cheerless. She seemed pleasantly surprised to see me there on a weekday afternoon.
"Look at these lovely old editions,"
she said, showing me a couple of small tan books, their bindings still glossy and moist from the lanolin, like newly exposed conkers. I hitched up a stool and sat beside her. She opened one of the books and began to turn its pages. She said,
"I haven't got very far, to tell the truth. It's always more tempting to read than to work. I found something just now, a bit of Herrick that made me smile. Here it is."
The book creaked as she eased back its covers.
"Just listen to this, and tell me what it reminds you of."
And she began to read aloud in her low-pitched, pleasant voice.
"The tongues of kids shall be thy meat, their milk thy drink, and thou shalt eat. The paste of filberts for thy bread, with cream of cowslips buttered. Thy feasting tables shall be hills, with daisies spread and daffodils, where thou shalt sit and redbreast by, for meat shall give thee melody."
She lifted her head.
"That might have been put out as a broadcast by the Ministry of Food, don't you think? It's all there except the ration book. I wonder what the paste of filberts tastes like."
I said, "Like peanut butter, I shouldn't wonder."
"You're right. Only even nastier."
We smiled at each other. She put down the Herrick and picked up the book she had been working on when I arrived and started rubbing at it with firm, even strokes. But when I told her what was on my mind, that I wanted to talk about Roderick, her hand slowed and her smile faded. She said,
"I was wondering how much it had all struck you. I'd been thinking of talking to you myself, but what with everything else?"
That was as close as she ever came to mentioning the business with Jip, and as she spoke she dipped her head so that I saw her lowered eyelids heavy and moist and curiously nude-looking above her dry cheeks. She said,
"He keeps saying he's all right, but I know he isn't. Mother knows it, too. That business with a door, for instance. When did Rod ever leave his door open at night? And he was almost raving when he came to, despite what he says. I think he's having nightmares. He keeps hearing noises when nothing's there."
She reached for the jar of lanolin and dabbled her fingers inside it.
"He didn't tell you, I suppose, about coming up to my room in the night last week?"
"To your room?" I'd heard nothing of this.
She nodded, glancing up at me as she worked.
He woke me up. I don't know what time it was. Long before dawn, anyway. I didn't know what on earth was going on. He came barging in, saying, "Would I, for God's sake, please stop shifting things about? It was driving him mad." Then he saw me in bed, and I swear he turned green. Greenery-yallery, just like his eye. His room is almost underneath mine, you know, and he said he'd been lying there for an hour, listening to me dragging things across the floor. He thought I'd been rearranging the furniture. He'd been dreaming, of course. The house was quiet as a church. It always is. But the dream seemed realer to him than I did. That was the horrible thing. It took him forever to calm down. In the end, I made him get into bed beside me. I went back to sleep, but I don't know if he did. I think he lay awake all the rest of that night. Wide awake, I mean, as if he were watching or waiting for something.
Her words made me thoughtful. I said, "He didn't pass out. Anything like that?"
"Pass out?"
"He couldn't have been having some sort of seizure?"
"A fit, you mean? Oh, no, it was nothing like that. There was a girl when I was young who threw fits. I remember they were horrible things. I don't think I could make a mistake about that."
"Well," I said, "not all seizures are the same. It makes a sort of sense, after all. His injuries, his confusion, his queer behaviour." She shook her head, looking sceptical.
"I don't know. I don't think it was that. And why should he start having seizures now? He's never had them before."
"Well, perhaps he has. Would he have told you? People have an odd sense of shame about epilepsy." She frowned, thinking it over. Then she shook her head again.
"I just don't think that's it."
Wiping the lanolin from her fingers, then screwing on the lid of the jar, she got to her feet. The narrow strip of window showed a swiftly darkening sky, and the room seemed colder and gloomier than ever. She said,
"God, it's like an ice house in here."
She blew into her hands.
"Help me with this, could you?"
She meant the tray of treated books. I moved forward to lift it with her, and we set it on a table. She dusted down her skirt and said, without looking up,
"Where's Rod now, do you know?"
I said, "I saw him outside with Barrett when I arrived, heading over to the old gardens." "Why, you think we should talk to him?"
"No, it's not that. It's just... have you been to his room lately?"
"His room? Not lately, no. He doesn't seem to want me there."
"He doesn't seem to want me there, either. But I happened to go in a couple of days ago when he was out, and I noticed something... well, something odd. I don't know if it'll back up your epilepsy theory or not. I rather think not. But will you come and let me show you? If Barrett's got hold of Rod, there'll be ages."
I didn't care for the idea. "I'm not sure we ought to, Caroline. Rod wouldn't like it, would he?"
"It won't take long, and it's the sort of thing I'd like you to see for yourself. Please, will you come? I've no one else to talk to about it."
That was more or less the feeling that had brought me to her, and since she was clearly so troubled, I said I would. She led me out into the hall, and we went quietly on down the passage towards Rod's room. It was late in the afternoon after Mrs. Baisley had gone home, but as we drew near to the curtained arch which led to the service regions, we could hear the faint chatter of the wireless, which meant that Betty was at work in the kitchen. Caroline glanced over at the curtain as she turned the handle of Roderick's door, and winced at the creaking of the lock.
"You mustn't think I make a habit of this sort of thing," she murmured, when we were inside. "If anyone comes, I'll lie, and say we were looking for a book or something. You mustn't be shocked by that, either. Here's what I want you to see."
I'd expected her, I don't know why, to lead me to Rod's desk and papers. Instead, she remained at the door she had just closed and gestured to the back of it. The door was panelled in oak to match the walls of the room, and like just about everything else at Hundreds, the oak was not at its best. I could imagine the wood in its heyday having had a glorious, ruddy lustre. Now, though still impressive, it was bleached and slightly streaky, and some of the sections had shrunk and cracked. But the panel at which Caroline pointed had a different sort of mark on it. The mark was at about breast height, and it was small and black, like a scorch mark, just like a mark I could remember seeing on the floorboards of the little terraced house I grew up in, where my mother had once set down an iron while laundering clothes. I looked quizzically at Caroline. "What is it?"
"You tell me."
I moved in closer. "Rod's been lighting candles and let one fall?"
"That's what I thought at first. There's a table, you see, not far off. The generator has failed us a couple of times recently. I thought that for some queer reason Rod must have put the table here with a candle on it, and that I supposed he'd fallen asleep or something, and a candle had burned itself over. I was pretty annoyed about it, as you can imagine. I told him please not to be such an idiot as ever to do it again.
And what did he say?
He said he hadn't been lighting candles. If the power goes, he uses that lamp over there.
She indicated an old Tilly lamp, sitting on a bureau on the other side of the room.
Mrs. Baisley says the same. She keeps a drawerful of candles downstairs for when the generator fails, and according to her, Rod hasn't taken any of them. He says he doesn't know how the mark got here. He hadn't noticed it before I pointed it out. But he didn't seem to like the look of it either. It seemed to... well, to spook him.
I moved close to the door again to run my fingers over the smudge. It left no trace of soot on them, nor any kind of scent, and its surface was quite smooth. The more I studied it, in fact, the more it seemed to me that the mark had the faintest sort of bloom or patina over it, as though it had somehow developed just below the surface of the wood. I said, "This couldn't have been here for some time without your having seen it."
"I don't think so. I think it would have caught my eye whenever I closed or opened the door. And don't you remember the very first time you treated Rod's leg? I stood just about here and complained about the panels. The mark wasn't there then. I'm certain it wasn't. Betty knows nothing about it. Neither does Mrs. Baisley."
Her casual mention, not of Mrs. Baisley, but of Betty, made me thoughtful. I said, "You brought Betty here and showed her the mark?"
"I brought her quietly, like this. She was as surprised by it as I was."
"Was she really, do you think? You don't think she might have been responsible for it somehow, then been too frightened to own up? She might have been walking past this door with an oil lamp in her hand, or maybe she spilled something here, some sort of cleaning solution."
"Cleaning solution?" said Caroline. "There's nothing stronger in the kitchen cupboards than meths and liquid soap. I should know. I've used them often enough. No, Betty has her moods, but I don't think she's a liar. And anyhow, that's by the by. I came back in here yesterday when Rod was out and had another look around. I found nothing strange until I did this."
She put back her head and looked upwards, and I did the same. The mark leapt out at me at once. It was on the ceiling this time, that plaster latticework ceiling stained yellow with nicotine. It was a small, dark, formless smudge, exactly like the one on the door, and again it looked just as though someone had put a flame or an iron there, long enough to scorch the plaster but not to blister it. Caroline was watching my face.
"I'd like to know," she said, "how even a very careless parlour maid could be careless enough to put a burn mark on the ceiling 12 feet off the floor."
I stared at her for a second, then moved across the room until the smudge was right over my head. I said, squinting upwards, "Is it really the same as the other?"
"Yes. I even brought in the stepladder and had a look. If anything, it's worse. There's nothing underneath that might account for it, only, as you see, Rod's washing stand. Even if he'd put the tilly on that, the distance involved. Well..."
"And it's definitely a scorch, or a burn. It isn't, I don't know, some sort of chemical reaction?"
"A chemical reaction that can make antique oak panels and plaster ceilings start smouldering all by themselves? Not to mention this. Look over here."
With a slightly giddy sense now, I followed her over to the fireplace, and she showed me the heavy Victorian ottoman that sat beside it, on the opposite side to the kindling box. Sure enough, the leather was marked, apparently, in exactly the same way as the door and the ceiling, with a small, dark smudge. I said, "This is too much, Caroline. The ottoman could have been marked like this for years. Probably a spark from the fire once caught it. The ceiling might have been marked for a long time, too. I don't think I'd have noticed."
"Perhaps you're right," she said. "I hope you are. But you don't think it's odd about this and the door? The door being the one that Rod walked into, I mean, the night he blacked his eye, and this being the thing he tripped over?"
I said, "It was this he fell over? I'd been picturing some dainty footstool. But this must weigh a ton. How could it have found its way across the room like that?"
"That's what I'd like to know. And why is it marked in this queer way, as if it were, well, marked out? It's just so creepy."
"And you've asked Rod about these?"
"I showed him the mark on the door and the one on the ceiling, but not this. His reaction to the others was too odd."
"Odd?"
"He seemed furtive. I don't know. Guilty.
She said the word reluctantly, and I looked at her and began to make out the anxious movement of her ideas. I said quietly, "You think he's been making these marks himself, don't you?" She answered unhappily,
"I don't know. But perhaps in his sleep? Or in the sort of fit you mentioned? After all, if he can do other things, if he can open doors and move furniture about and get himself injured, if he can come up to my room at 3 o'clock in the morning to ask me to stop moving furniture, then couldn't he also do something like this?"
She glanced at the door and lowered her voice.
"And if he can do this, Doctor, well, what else might he do?"
I thought it over for a moment. "Have you mentioned this to your mother?"
"No, I haven't wanted to worry her. And then what is there to tell, really? Just a few funny marks? I don't know why they bother me so much." "No, that's not true. I do know."
She grew awkward.
"It's because we've had trouble with Rod before. Do you know about that?"
"Your mother told me a little," I said. "I'm sorry, it must have been tough." She nodded.
"It was a bad, bad time. All Rod's injuries were at their worst, his scars ghastly, his legs so bashed about it really seemed as though he might be more or less a cripple for the rest of his life. But he wouldn't do anything to get himself better. That was the maddening thing. He just sat in here, brooding and smoking. Drinking, too, I think. You know his navigator died when their plane came down. I think he blamed himself for that. It was nobody's fault, of course. No one's but the Germans, I mean. But they say it's always hard on the pilots when their crews are lost. The boy was younger than Roddy, only just 19. Rod used to say that it ought to have been the other way around, that the boy had had more to live for than he did. That was fun for Mother and me to hear, as you can imagine."
I said, "I can. Has he said anything like that lately?"
"Not to me. Nor to Mother, as far as I know. But I can tell she's afraid of his getting sick again, too. Perhaps it's just because we're afraid. We're imagining too much. I don't know. There's just something not right here. Something's going on with Rod. It's as though there's a hoodoo on him. He hardly goes out any more, you know, even to the farm. He just stays in here saying he's going over his papers. But look at them."
She gestured to his desk and to the table beside his chair, both of which were nearly obscured by deep, untidy piles of letters and ledgers and flimsy typewritten sheets. She said,
"He's drowning in all this stuff, but he won't let me help him. He says he has a system, and I won't understand. Does this look like a system to you? Practically the only person he allows to come in here these days is Betty. At least she keeps the carpet swept and empties his ashtrays. I wish he'd get away for a while, take a holiday or something. But he never would. He won't leave the estate. And it isn't even as though his being here makes any real difference. The estate's doomed, whatever he does."
She lowered herself heavily onto the marked ottoman and rested her chin in her hands.
"Sometimes I think he ought to just let it go."
She spoke wearily, but matter-of-factly, letting her eyes almost close, and again I was conscious of the curious nudeness of her slightly swollen eyelids. I gazed down at her, perturbed.
"You don't mean that, Caroline. You can bear to lose hundreds, surely."
Again she spoke almost casually.
"Oof, but I've been brought up to lose it. To lose it, I mean, once Rod marries. The new Mrs. Ayres won't want a spinster sister-in-law about the place, nor a mother-in-law come to that. That's the stupidest thing of all. So long as Roddy goes on holding the estate together, too tired and distracted to find a wife, and probably killing himself in the process, so long as he goes on like that, Mother and I get to stay here. Meanwhile, hundreds is such a drain on us, it's hardly worth staying for."
Her voice faded, and we stayed without speaking until the silence in that insulated room began to grow oppressive. I looked again at those three queer scorch marks. They were like the burns, I realized suddenly, on Rod's own face and hands. It was as if the house were developing scars of its own, in response to his unhappiness and frustration, or to Caroline's, or her mother's, perhaps to the griefs and disappointments of the whole family. The thought was horrible. I could see what Caroline meant about the marked walls and furniture being creepy. I must have shuddered. Caroline got up. She said,
"Look here, I'm sorry to have told you all this. It really isn't your trouble."
I said,
"Oh, but it is, in a way."
"It is?
Well, since I've more or less become Rod's doctor." She gave her rueful smile.
"Yes. Well, but you haven't really, have you? It's just how you said the other day. Rod isn't paying you to come here. You can dress it up how you like. I know you're treating him now more or less as a favour. It's awfully kind of you, but you mustn't let us draw you into any more of our problems. Do you remember what I told you about this house, when I showed you round it? It's greedy. It gobbles up all our time and energy. It'll gobble up yours if you let it."
I didn't answer for a second. I'd had a vision, not of Hundreds Hall, but of my own home, with its neat, plain, undemanding, utterly lifeless rooms. I would be returning to them later, to a bachelor's supper of cold meat and boiled potatoes, and half a bottle of flat beer. I said firmly, "I'm happy to help you, Caroline. Truly I am."
"You mean it?"
"Yes. I don't know what's going on here any more than you do, but I'd like to help you figure it out. I'll take my chances with the hungry house, don't worry about that. I'm a pretty indigestible fellow, you know." She smiled properly then, and briefly closed her eyes again.
"Thank you," she said.
After that we didn't linger. We began to be afraid of Rod's returning and discovering us there, so we made our way quietly back to the library, for Caroline to tidy the room and close the shutter. Then, trying to shake off our anxieties, we went to the little parlour to join her mother. But I stayed puzzling over Roderick's condition for the next few days, and it must have been on an afternoon early in the following week that the whole thing at last came together. Or, depending on how one looks at it, fell apart. I was driving back through Lidcote at about 5 o'clock, and was surprised to see Rod himself on the High Street. His presence there would once have been unremarkable, for in the old days he often used to come in on farming business. But, as Caroline had said, he rarely left Hundreds now, and though he still looked very much the young country squire, in an overcoat and tweed cap and with the strap of a leather satchel across his breast, there was something unmistakably burdened and ill at ease about him, about the way he walked, with his collar turned up and his shoulders hunched, as if against more than the chill November breezes. When I drew up across the street from him to wind down my window and call his name, he turned to me with a startled expression, and just for a second, I could have sworn it, he looked like a frightened, hunted man. He came slowly over to the car, and I asked him what had brought him into the village. He told me he had been to see Maurice Babb, the big local builder. The county council had recently bought up the last free parcel of Eyre's farmland. They planned to build a new housing estate on it, with Babb as the contractor. He and Rod had just been running through the final agreement.
"He makes me come into his office like a tradesman," Rod said bitterly. "Imagine if a man like that had suggested such a thing to my father. He knows I'll do it, of course. He knows I've no choice."
He drew close the lapels of his overcoat and again looked burdened and miserable. I couldn't offer him many words of comfort over the sale of the land. In fact, I was pleased to hear about the new houses, which were badly needed in the area. But thinking of his leg, I said, "You didn't walk in."
"No, no," he answered. "Barrett managed to whistle me up some fuel, so I drove."
He gestured with his chin along the High Street, and I caught sight of the Ayres' distinctive car, a shabby old black and ivory Rolls-Royce, parked a little way along it. He said,
"I thought she might give up the ghost on the way here. That would have been just about the last straw, but she made it all right."
He sounded more like his old self now. I said,
"Well, let's hope she gets you home again. You don't have to hurry back, I take it. Come in with me for a while and warm yourself up." "Oh, I can't," he said at once.
"Why not?" His gaze slid away from mine.
"I oughtn't to keep you from your work."
"Nonsense. I've almost an hour before evening surgery, and this is always a dead time for me. I've hardly seen you lately. Come on." He was obviously reluctant, but I kept up a light but determined pressure, and he finally agreed to come in with me,
just for 5 minutes.
I parked the car and met him at the door to my house. Since none of the upstairs fires were lit, I took him into my dispensary. I brought a chair from behind the counter and set it with another, close to the room's ancient tortoise stove, which had just enough live embers in it to be kindled into a blaze. I spent a few minutes seeing to that, and by the time I had straightened, Rod had taken off his cap and put down his satchel and was going slowly around the room. He was looking at the shelves, where I kept some of the quaint old jars and instruments that had once belonged to Dr. Gill. His mood, I was glad to see, seemed to have lifted slightly. He said,
"Here's that beastly leech jar that used to give me such nightmares when I was a kid. Probably old Dr. Gill never even kept any leeches in it, did he?"
I said, "I'm afraid he probably did. He was just the sort of man to have faith in leeches. Leeches and licorice and cod liver oil. Take your coat off, won't you? I won't be a tick. As I spoke, I went through to my consulting room next door to open a drawer in my desk and bring out a bottle and two glasses. "Now, I don't want you to think," I said, showing the bottle as I returned, "that it's my custom to drink before six, but you look like you need cheering up, and it's only some old brown sherry. I keep it on hand for pregnant women. They either want to celebrate, you see, or they need something to get them over the shock." He smiled, but the smile fell quickly from his face. "I've just been given a drink by Bab. No old brown sherry for him, I assure you. He said we ought to toast the completion of the contract, that if we didn't, it would bring bad luck. I nearly said that as far as I was concerned, I'd had my bad luck. Selling the land was part of it. As for the money it's brought in, would you believe me if I told you that's practically spent already?" But he took the glass I gave him and touched it to mine. To my surprise, the liquor trembled in his hand, and perhaps to hide the tremor he took one swift sip, then began to roll the stem of the glass back and forth between his fingers. As we moved to the chairs, I looked at him more closely. I saw the tense yet curiously lifeless way in which he lowered himself into his seat. He might have had odd little weights inside him, rolling unpredictably about. I said lightly, "You look done in, Rod." He lifted his hand to wipe his lip. His wrist was still bandaged, the crepe now soiled and frayed at the palm. "It must be this business with the land," he said. "You shouldn't take it so personally. There are probably 100 landowners in England in exactly your position, all doing just what you've done today." "There are probably 1,000, he answered, but without much force. "All the fellows I used to know at school, and all the chaps I used to fly with. Every time I hear from one of them, they're telling the same story. Most of them have run through their settlements already. Some are having to take jobs. Their parents are living on their nerves. I opened a newspaper this morning. A bishop was sounding off about the shame of the German. Why doesn't anyone write a piece on the shame of the Englishman, the ordinary hard-working Englishman who since the war has had to watch his property and income vanishing like so much smoke? Meanwhile, grubby little businessmen like Bab are doing all right, and men without land, without family, without the eyes of the county on them, men like that bloody Baker Hyde." His voice had tightened, and he didn't finish. He put back his head and swallowed the rest of his sherry, then started to twirl the empty glass between his fingers, even more restlessly than before. His gaze had turned inwards suddenly. He seemed alarmingly out of reach. He made some movement, and again I had that sense that there were unmoored weights inside him, making him jerky and off balance. I was dismayed, too, by his reference to Peter Baker Hyde. It gave me a glimpse, I thought, of what might have been troubling him all this time. It was as though he'd made a sort of fetish of the man, with his handsome wife and his money and his good war record. I leaned towards him. "Listen, Rod, you mustn't go on like this. This Baker Hyde fixation, or whatever it is. Let it go, can't you? Concentrate on what you've got, rather than what you think you haven't. Plenty of men would envy you, you know." He looked at me with a queer expression.
"Envy me?"
"Yes. Look at that house you're living in, for one thing. I know it's tough work keeping it going, but for goodness sake, can't you see that by holding on to this sort of resentment, you're hardly making things easier for your mother and sister? I don't know what's got into you lately. If there's something on your mind..."
"God!" he said, flaring up. "If you like the damn house so much, why don't you try running it? I'd like to see you. You've no idea. Don't you know that if I were to stop, even for a moment..."
He swallowed, his Adam's apple jerking painfully in his slender throat.
"Stop what?"
I said.
"Stop holding everything back, keeping it at bay. Don't you know that in every second of every day the whole damn thing's in danger of crashing down and taking me and Caroline and Mother down with it? God, you haven't a clue, none of you. It's killing me."
He put a hand on the back of his chair and made a move as if to push himself up, but then he seemed to change his mind and abruptly sat down again. Now he was definitely trembling. I didn't know if it was with upset or with anger, but I looked away for a minute or two, wanting to give him time to pull himself together. The stove wasn't drawing as it should. I moved forward to fiddle with the draught, but as I did it, I grew aware that Rod was fidgeting. Soon he was fidgeting so badly there was something unnatural about it.
"Hell," I heard him say, in a soft, desperate voice.
I looked properly at him and saw that he was pale and sweating and shaking like a man in a fever. Alarmed, I got up. I thought for a moment that I must have been right about the epilepsy, that he was going into a seizure right there in front of me, but he put a hand across his face.
"Don't look at me," he said.
"What?"
"Don't look at me! Stand over there!"
Then I realized that he was not ill, but in the grip of a dreadful panic, and his embarrassment at my seeing him like this was making him worse. So I turned my back on him and went over to the window, and stood gazing out through the dusty net curtain. I remember the bitter, ticklish scent of it even now. I said, "Rod,
don't watch me!"
"I'm not watching. I'm looking out at the high street." I could hear his rapid, laboured breathing, the catch of tears in his throat. I made my voice very level. I said, "I can see my car. I'm afraid she wants washing and polishing rather badly. I can see yours, further down, looking even worse. There's Mrs. Walker and her little boy. There's Enid from the Desmonds. She's in a temper, by the look of it. She's put her hat on crooked. There's Mr. Crouch come out to his step to shake a cloth. May I look at you now?"
"No! Stay like that. Keep talking."
"Keep talking. All right. Funny how hard it is to keep talking, when someone asks you to start and not stop. And I'm more used, of course, to listening. Have you ever thought of that, Rod, about how much listening one has to do in this job of mine? I often think that we family doctors are like priests. People tell us their secrets because they know we won't judge them. They know we're used to looking at human beings, as it were, without their skins. Some doctors don't like it. I've known one or two who've seen so much weakness they've developed a sort of contempt for mankind. I've known doctors, many doctors, more than you'd guess, who've taken to drink. Others of us, though, it humbles. We see what a punishing business it is, simply being alive. Just being alive. Not to mention having wars and what not thrown at one, and estates and farms to run. Most people, you know, seem to muddle through all right in the end." I slowly turned back to him. He met my gaze with a wretched expression, but didn't protest. He was holding himself impossibly tensely, breathing through his nose with his mouth shut tight. His face was bloodless. Even the taut, smooth skin of his scars had lost its colour. There was only the fading, yellow-green bruise at his eye, and his cheeks were wet with sweat, and perhaps with tears. But he was over the worst of it, and growing calmer as I watched. I went across to him and got out a packet of cigarettes, and he took one gratefully, though he had to hold it to his mouth with both his hands while I put the flame to it. As he blew out the first uneven plume of smoke, I said quietly, "What's going on, Rod?" He wiped his face and lowered his head.
"Nothing's going on. I'm all right now."
"All right?
Look at you. It's the strain of keeping on top of it. It wants me to buckle, that's all. I shan't give in to it. It knows that, you see, and keeps trying harder."
He spoke breathlessly, still and miserably, but in a measured kind of way, and the combination of anguish and reason in his words and manner was unnerving. I went back to my chair, and when I had sat, I said quietly again, "What's going on? I know something is. Won't you tell me?" He raised his eyes to me without lifting his head.
"I want to," he said with wretched simplicity. "But it'll be better for your sake if I don't."
"Why is that?"
"It might infect you."
"Infect me? I treat infections every day, don't forget."
"Not like this."
"Why? What is this like?" He dropped his gaze.
"It's a filthy thing."
He spoke with a look and a gesture of disgust. And at that particular combination of words, infection and filthy, an idea began to break upon me about what his trouble might be. I was so surprised and dismayed, and yet so relieved that his predicament should turn out to be such a mundane one, that I almost smiled. I said, "Is it that, Rod? For God's sake, why didn't you come to me sooner?" He looked at me, not understanding, and when I spoke more plainly, so that it was clear what I meant, he broke into a ghastly-sounding laugh.
"Dear God!"
he said, wiping his face.
"'If it were as simple a thing as that. "'As for telling you my symptoms,'
his expression grew bleak,
"'you won't believe me if I do.'
I said urgently, "'Try me, will you?'
"'I told you, I want to.'
"'Well, when did they first appear, these symptoms of yours?'
"'When? When do you think? The night of that wretched party.'
I had sensed this all along. "'You had a headache,' your mother said. "'Was that the start?'
"'The headache was nothing. I only said that to hide the other thing, the real thing.'
I could see him struggling. I said, "'Tell me, Rod.' He put a hand to his mouth to push his lip between his teeth.
"'If it should get out—'
I misunderstood. "'I give you my word, I'll tell no one.' That alarmed him.
"'No, you mustn't do that. You mustn't tell my mother or my sister.'
"'Not if you don't want me to.'
"'You said you were a sort of priest, remember? A priest keeps secrets, doesn't he? You must promise me.'
"'I promise, Rod.'
"'You mean it?'
"'Of course.' He looked away from me and worked at his lip again, and was silent for so long I thought he'd retreated into himself and I had lost him. But then he drew unsteadily on his cigarette and gestured with his glass.
"'All right. God knows it'll be a relief to share it with someone at last. But you must give me another drink first. I can't face it sober.'
I poured him out a large measure. His hands were still shaking too hard for him to be able to pour it for himself, and he swallowed it down in one gulp, then asked for another. And when he had drunk that, he began, slowly and haltingly, to tell me exactly what had happened to him on the night the little Baker Hyde girl was hurt. He had, as I knew, been dubious about the party from the start. He hadn't liked the sound of the Baker Hydes, he said. He was uncomfortable with the idea of playing master of the house, and he felt a fool about putting on evening clothes, which he hadn't worn in about 3 years. But he'd gone along with it all for Caroline's sake and to please his mother. On the evening in question he really had been delayed at the farm, though he knew that everyone would suppose he'd simply been dawdling. He'd been kept there by a piece of failing machinery, for just as Makins had been predicting for weeks, the Hundreds pump had looked like it was finally about to blow, and leaving the farm to deal with the problem without help was out of the question. Rod knew as much about things like that as any mechanic, thanks to his time in the RAF. He and Makins's son patched up the pump and kept it working. But it took until well past 8 o'clock. By the time he had crossed the park and was hurriedly letting himself back into the hall by the garden door, the Baker Hydes and Mr. Morley were already arriving at the front. He was still in his farm clothes, and filthy with dust and grease. He didn't think he had time enough to go upstairs and have a proper wash in the family bathroom. He thought he'd make do with hot water in the bowl of his washing stand. He rang for Betty, but she was busy with the guests in the saloon. He waited, then rang again. Then finally he went down to the kitchen to fetch the water himself. "Now," he said, came the first queer thing. His evening clothes were on his bed, laid out and waiting to be put on. Like lots of ex-servicemen, he was a neat and orderly dresser, and he had brushed the garments down himself earlier that day, then set them ready. When he had returned from the kitchen and hastily washed, he put on his trousers and his shirt, then looked for his collar, and couldn't find it. He lifted the jacket and looked beneath it. He looked under the bed, looked everywhere, in every likely and unlikely place. The wretched collar was nowhere to be found. This was all the more maddening because the collar in question was, of course, an evening one, meant to go with the shirt he was wearing. It was one of the few unpatched or unturned collars he had left, so he couldn't simply go to the drawer and bring out another.
"'How idiotic it sounds, doesn't it?' he said to me miserably. "'I knew it was idiotic even at the time. I didn't want to go to the bloody party in the first place, but there I was, the host, supposedly, the master of Hundreds, keeping everyone waiting, chasing around the room like a twit because I only owned one decent stand-up collar.
It was at this point that Betty arrived, sent by Mrs. Ayres to find out what was keeping him. He told her what the matter was, and asked if she had moved the collar herself. She said she hadn't seen it since that morning, when she had brought it up to his room with the rest of his laundry. He said,
"'Well, for God's sake, help me look, will you?'
And she spent a minute searching with him, looking in all the places he'd already looked, and finding nothing. Until at last he grew so frustrated with the whole business, he told her,
"'Rather sharply, I'm afraid,
to let things alone and go back to his mother. When she had gone, he gave the search up. He went to his drawer to do what he could to improvise an evening collar out of one of his daytime ones. Had he known